Welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
We're learning from the survivors from the Deep South during Black American History Month 2013. I'm Alex Smith. We all want to be survivors, so let's learn from those who know. Why not farm in the city? Our guest is a Harvard grad with plenty of big-time qualifications in both industrial and organic agriculture. K. Rashid Nouri worked a dozen years with the world food giant Cargill. He served 4 years in the Clinton administration in the U.S. Department of Agriculture. Right now in Atlanta, Georgia, Rashid leads an inspiring urban food farm called Truly Living Well. Rashid Nouri, thank you for joining us on Radio EcoShock.
Oh, thank you for having me. I appreciate the opportunity to speak with you and your guests.
Well, right at the start, everybody's going to want to know, what is Truly Living Well? Please tell us about that.
Truly Living Well, this is our eighth season here in the metropolitan Atlanta area. We grow quality food. We have three planks to our program. We grow quality food, and those quality we sell to the top restaurants in town. We also sell directly to the public through our CSA program, Community Supported Agriculture Program, where people pay us in advance. We have a discounted program for seniors. We also participate in the Wholesome Way program, so folks that are on welfare and have food stamps get double the value. For every dollar they spend, we give them $2 worth of food, and if someone's hungry, we just give it to them. Our second plank is agricultural education, horticultural literacy. I think it's important that people know who grows their food, the quality of their food, and where their food comes from. And we do that. We have classes. We have an urban growers training program where every 6 months we take on 20 new trainees, put them through field experience as well as classroom training, then mentor them for another year after that. We have a summer camp. Last year we did four two-week sessions of summer camp for children from 6 to 14. We give weekly classes. Agriculture education and outreach is important. Third leg is community building, community development. And one of the metrics I am most proud of is the fact that we have over 30 people on our payroll. So we create jobs and contribute to the local food economy that way. And it's not just the dollars, but in areas where we operate, we raise property values.
And how do you find new plots of land to work in the Atlanta area?
Atlanta is the greenest city in America by virtue of trees and open space. We can grow food 52 weeks a year, and there's enough land in the metropolitan area to provide all the fruits and vegetables we need to feed everybody. So land is not the issue. What is the issue are the resources and the infrastructure to be in place to be able to support urban agriculture. Short answer is people bring me land all the time.
And where do you get the support that you need?
It comes from multiple sources. You know, we have good enough several, probably 14 or 15 revenue streams around our work itself in the garden. We get grants from private corporations, foundations, and individuals. So we get money any way we can keep us going.
You've worked with big agriculture. Why did you take this turn towards local food production?
Well, that's an interesting question because, in this sense, the very first work that I did out of university was put in organic gardens out in San Diego County. This was back in the early 70s. So I had an interest in local food for quite a long time. Just now that at this stage of my career, it's gone full circle. I'm back to doing what I did when I started. So it's not new. I set out to learn everything about food from the seed to the table. This is why I went to work for companies like Cargill, because Cargill moves food better than anybody else, and gave me an opportunity to learn how food is moved around the world. And able to bring that back, I looked at local food economy. I've worked in over 35 countries around the world. And I've had a chance to see how local food economies are organized and the elements that go into it, and able to bring that back to inform my work today.
And I'm thinking that this is more than just about feeding people. You mentioned there's a deeper social dimension to this project.
Oh, absolutely. And I think this is one of the metrics, the econometrics that we want to bring to the work. We're working with a couple of universities now, and the challenge that I've given the young people, the students, as well as the professors, is to help us come up with an evaluative modality for demonstrating the value of the work that we do, the value of urban agriculture, because it's more than just dollars and cents or pounds and yields. The health benefits that people derive from just coming out and working in the fields. We had a young lady last year, a child who had high blood pressure, and after spending a couple of weeks in our camp, eating the nutritious food that came from the garden, and her numbers came down enough they were able to get her off of the medication, and she stayed off. Okay, the property values around our facilities have increased. We've been able to cut crime and vice in the neighborhoods in which we have worked. I'm finding developers these days no longer finding that swimming pools and tennis courts have the same attractive, they're not as attractive as amenities as they used to be. And they're looking for something new. And I contend that edible landscaping is the way to go. If you're going to sit under a tree, why not sit under a tree that can provide some food for you also? You plant a shade tree, plant an apple tree. It's going to give you more than just shade. It's going to give you food to eat. And I think that's a very important thing to look at, is all the other ways that we can contribute to the health, the safety, environmental justice, greening of the city. When you stop to consider that 80% of Americans live in urban areas, think about that, 80%. You go to a country like India, 80% of the citizens of India live in the rural areas. Only 20% in those cities, even though they are teeming, that's only 20% of the population. All of our Americans live in cities, 80% live in cities, so why shouldn't the food be where we are? It's going to cut down on the carbon footprints. Local food is healthier for you. It's the same vibration that you have, and it's a contributor to our economy. It's a contributor to the development of our metropolitan areas rather than a detractor. The whole agricultural paradigm in this country is shifting. Where, you know, if you go out, some of the people would talk about food deserts, and they often think of black people or Hispanics in the inner city who are underserved. And I don't like that notion, because southwest corner of Georgia is the grain belt of the state, and the worst health statistics in the state of Georgia are where in the rural areas where the farmers live. They have to drive 20 or 30 miles to get to a grocery store. Farmers used to keep a portion of the land to grow a garden to feed themselves. They don't do that anymore. You know, and now they're out there with what I call those chemistry sets, all those chemicals that they're eating every day from their farming practices, and they're the unhealthiest people that there are around. And I have a problem with that. So, and the paradigm is shifting so that the production out in the countryside is primarily commodity crops, corn, wheat, soybeans, peanuts, cotton, and not the vegetables. Vegetables being imported from very long distances. So the farmer and the farmers are not able to support themselves from their own production. This is why you see the rise of the farmers' markets, and farmers now, particularly vegetable farmers, getting the food directly into the hands of the consumers through farmers' markets and other mechanisms, as well as the local food economies, urban agriculture, and bypassing those commodity brokers and the food brokers who provide the choke in the food chain.
Yeah, I understand what you're saying. You've just raised two huge issues. Why don't we tackle the first one? I noticed you were speaking to a group of black farmers and urban gardeners at a conference, and you brought up some shocking statistics that nearly 50% of African-American children may develop diabetes at some point in their lives, that deaths from heart disease and stroke are almost twice the rate for African-Americans compared to whites. A lot of that has to do with food, doesn't it?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Access to food. You see, and again, that term food desert here in the city, people, as soon as you say food desert, they're thinking about African-American children. Okay? But white people live in food deserts also. The difference is they have the means of transportation to get to food sources, where sometimes people in the black community, Hispanic community, don't have the access to the transportation to get to the food. Okay? And the food that you find in these communities is really not that good. So there is a direct connection between food and health. Now, I think you're going to find, as we move to the future, that I have already established that there is a direct connection between the introduction of chemical agriculture, hybrid seeds, and now GMOs with the ill health of our population. All the debilitating diseases that we have, there's a direct correlation between increasing the chemicals, increasing the use of hybrid seed, and people are getting sick. Our bodies have not evolved to the point where we can metabolize the food that's being produced. So therefore, they're constantly fighting back against what the body is fighting back against, the input. So there is a direct correlation between the food that people eat or the food that people don't eat even, and the health of the community. And the statistics are frightening. They really are.
They are frightening, but they can be fixed, and I think you're taking a step in the right direction. But you also raised the issue of African-American farming, and, you know, I did a little Google search on that because I'm kind of ignorant about it, I admit it. But what I found was mostly history lessons, and it sounds like, you know, in 1920s, you had 14% of U.S. farmers were African-American. By 2007, that's just 2%. What happened to the African-American farmer?
Well, now, let me back you up just a bit. I've got a couple of apples in the back basket of oranges. In 1910, black people owned 15 million acres of land. Okay, today we only own 2 million acres. The percentage of the population farming has decreased across the board. You have less than 2% of all Americans are direct producers of food today. You have a large percentage of people in the food chain as part of the processing, the distribution, and exchange of food, but actually growing it. That 2% figure that you use is not just black farmers, it's all farmers, white farmers too. It's all farmers. That having been said, the problem is in the black community has been black land loss. And that has come about through a number of factors. Most of the programs, the social support programs that have been created by this country have not benefited non-white populations. All right, so we want to talk about economic justice. That's an issue that quite often that no one wants to talk about it. So let me just give you just one example of many. I'll give you two. The Homestead Act of 1862 gave land to Europeans, gave 160 acres of land to anybody who had not raised arms against the United States. When Lincoln freed the slaves in 1863, the Civil War ended in 1865, you often hear about 40 acres and a mule. Black people never got those 40 acres, never mind the mule. Okay, it was only 40 acres. And when the slaves, black folks who upon whose backs this economy was built, they were not given any means of support after they were freed. So you're turning people loose. Instead, you give them freedom, but you don't give them the means to support themselves. All right, that's just one example. The other is Social Security. Social Security Act, which Congress is going to fight how we're going to keep funding Social Security. When that act was passed, it excluded agricultural workers and domestic workers. Okay, and at that time, most of the agricultural workers and the domestic workers were non-white. All right, so these are the ways that the society has excluded so many folks. Specifically about black land loss, it's been straight downhill because as folks moved from the South to the industrialized North, they sold off their land holdings. Then, come the 1960s, when Martin Luther King was his work was primarily in the South. And everywhere he marched, they got arrested. You know how they got out of jail? Black farmers put up their land. And the gentry throughout the South decided they were not going to put up with this and made a concerted effort to take that land back from black people. Now, one of the things that I did when I was at the Department of Agriculture was commissioned a disparity study to demonstrate that the ways in which black and Hispanic and actually poor white farmers had received disparate treatment by the Department of Agriculture. It came out as what's called the Miller Report, and since then we've had Pickford versus Glickman, the suits against the Department of Agriculture, which are still yet to be settled, for the discrimination against the farmers. And this discrimination will take place in some very insidious but simple ways. For example, if you go to the bank to borrow money to make a crop, you want to get that money in January and February so you can start making your crop in March and April. Right? But if you don't get your money until April or May and you put up your land, you can't make a crop, then they can take back your land. And this is what would happen to so many black farmers. They get their money late and weren't able to make a crop. So there's a lot of mechanisms that were in place to.
Yeah, there was just a $1.2 billion settlement announced, but because of the U.S. Department of Agriculture turning down farm loans to thousands of black American farmers.
Yeah, only people making any money on that are the lawyers. The first suit, Pickford won, the lawyers could bill unlimited hours. Pickford 2 was limited, but the farmers are also limited to only being allowed to receive $50,000. And the damage that was done far exceeds the $50,000, in many cases, far exceeded the $50,000 limits.
Do you think some African Americans turned away from farming because of the abuses in sharecropping, where really in some states they had laws they couldn't leave the land as long as they owed anything on the tab, but the tab just never seemed to go away, so they couldn't get out of there?
Yeah, absolutely. Sharecropping was still economic slavery. And, you know, when you got the same family farming the same piece of land for five generations and living in small houses with a single light bulb and outhouses on it, I saw that when I first came south. And that's still slavery. The different guys, different terminology, but it was still slavery. And it was very disheartening.
Yeah. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with Atlanta local food leader Rashid Nouri. Rashid, Michelle Obama planted a garden at the White House. She congratulated Walmart when that company announced they would start selling fresh vegetables. Is that a step in the right direction, do you think?
Not a controversy around that. I don't think, to me, organic produce grown in China and sold at Walmart is an oxymoron. And a lot of these big companies that want to buy some credibility, if you just look at the labels that are on food, natural, and all the phraseology that people use for the same garbage that they have been selling. Michelle Obama is where she sits. God bless her soul. She's doing the best she can to grow that food out there at the White House. There were some problems around that people didn't really get the publicity. But she's doing the best she can to promote good health. Walmart continues to exploit its workers. Okay? I don't know if you are old enough to remember when Walmart prided itself on saying 100% all of our products are made 100% in the United States. That's no longer true. That hadn't been true for a very long time. But that's what Sam Walton said. These were American products. So I think that Walmart is a part of the problem. I don't know that they're part of the solution. They will, you know, they gave Will Allen $1 million, which he's then redistributed to some of the folks that are associated. Will Allen is the icon of urban agriculture in this country. And they gave him $1 million. Some people, I know folk who dissociated with him because of that. But his attitude is you got to sit down at the table with people and forge conversations and collaborations to try to remedy some of the problems. I mean, he's using the money for a good thing, but there are those who think the source was tainted.
Well, Rashid Nouri, you're also a leader in the organic farming movement in Georgia. What's going on in Georgia in that?
Well, it's interesting. Georgia, there's another group called the Certified Naturally Grown, and Georgia has more certified naturally grown farmers than any other state in the union. And organic and certified naturally grown, they're very similar standards. The difference is the phrase USDA certified organic is a patented phrase. You have to pay a fee to get it. Certified naturally grown has same standards, but it's a peer-to-peer relationship. You don't have to pay anybody. Your peers do your evaluations of your growing technique. We have a number of movements here in Atlanta. I am in the state of Georgia. I'm the chairman of the Georgia Organics, which is a farmer, it's a membership organization that promotes organic agriculture, organic education, farm-to-school programs, mentorship programs throughout the state of Georgia. I'm on the part of Atlanta Local Food Initiative, which is a collaboration of folks who put together a manifesto on local food production, local food economy. And so it serves as a forum where people can sit down and talk to one another. I participate in a group called the Urban Food Abundance Movement, which is primarily black urban growers who are working to promote and support one another around urban food. So there's a lot going on. We have a couple of organizations. The Food Bank has a community gardening specialist who helps put together community gardens. Fred Conrad runs that. Bobby Wilson is also the president of the American Community Gardening Association. And he's been working with urban agriculture community gardens for over 20 years right here in the metropolitan area. So we got a lot going on. Slow Food is doing a lot of work here. We have some work. One woman, Susan Pavlin, is working with her thing is called Global Growers, where she works with the immigrant population, helping them to grow their ethnic foods, the tribal foods, as well as sell them within in the neighborhood. So there's a lot of good work going on. Joe Reynolds has a farm in the middle of the city, Gaia Gardens. We have farmers markets everywhere that are growing and expanding. So the consciousness about quality food is increasing. This is the horticultural literacy that I referenced earlier. People know who grows their food, the quality of their food, and where their food comes from. So we are making incremental successes. Someone asked me once, well, many times, what's the secret of my success? And that's just getting up every day and showing up and doing the work.
What tips would you offer to people in other cities that want to try and get something going like Truly Living Well?
Well, tips. You can always call me. Whatever I can do to help, I'd be glad to. But you need to look in your community and see what's going on. Talk to the Extension Service, which is a part of the university. You can get information on how to grow. Most cities have master growers programs. A lot of them are chemically based. But there are people locally. Find out where your local farmer's market is. Support your local farmers. And at the farmer's market, you're going to get fresher produce, higher quality produce. I mean, get to know the folks that are involved. And I think communication, people just sitting with one another is the most important thing. Just supporting one another. Knowledge, education, information.
And do you think that there's going to be some move towards more drought-resistant varieties or plants that can take the heat now that climate change may be coming worse?
Well, they're doing that. Now, I saw a piece yesterday on the Internet about cotton that collects 320% of its weight from moisture in the air to catch fog, you know, to help keep the plant wet. And I think that those kinds of innovations, I have a problem with. I'm old school. I am older. I think, as I said earlier, it's all these changes making heat-resistant food, those kind of things are killing people because we cannot metabolize what's coming out of the scientist laboratories. We need to preserve our seed, not give up the genetics to these large companies like Monsanto, and genes, splicing genes into these crops to make them resistant. I have a problem with that notion. I think we're tampering with nature in ways and that is going to have dire consequences in the future.
Well, I agree with you. Now, for people who want to follow your lead, do you have websites or books you would recommend?
Oh, yeah. Well, you can come check us out, TrueLivingWell.com. We keep a lot of information on there. You know, I mean, there's a lot of books out there, a lot of material. And everybody has a different method. Each neighborhood you grow in, each one of our farms is a little bit different. We have five of them around the city. But if you go to your bookstore, look online, there is a lot of information there. You can do a lot of studying and gain the knowledge just by doing your homework, having an interest, talking to people. Specific websites, no, I wouldn't want to give you out a list of them because there's just so many.
Well, certainly trulylivingwell.com is a good place to start. As we finish up, is there anything you'd like to add or that I've missed?
Oh, you know, it's a subject that I've been studying for over 40 years, and we could talk about this for days. But I hope that something that I've said today, by God's grace, will be helpful to someone. And if people are welcome to get in touch with me. And I'm just very pleased to have had this opportunity.
Our guest has been K. Rashid Nuri. After a distinguished career in agriculture in many parts of the world, he's returned to Atlanta, Georgia, to lead the nonprofit urban farming operation called Truly Living Well. And as I say, it's at trulylivingwell.com. I want to thank Heather Gray and Nadia Ali of the Just Peace Program on WFRG Atlanta for introducing me to Rashid. And thank you, Rashid, for all the work you're doing and for joining us on Radio EcoShock.
Thank you, sir, and peace be unto you.
I'm Alex Smith. You can download our past programs as free MP3s at my website, ecoshock.org. All I ask, please help when you can with a donation or subscription to Radio EcoShock, getting the message out all over the world. We began this program with Mavis Staples. Late in life, this famous gospel, soul, and civil rights singer released a kind of musical biography in the album called We'll Never Turn Back. So we'll finish off where we began. Down in Mississippi with Mavis Staples.
Down in Mississippi, way down.
Hey, as far back as I can remember, I either had a plow. Those are
with my grandma, Mississippi sun beaming down. I went to get some water. My grandma said, "Young'un, you can't drink that water." She said, "You drink from that fountain over there." Yeah. And that fountain had a sign. For colored only. I was so glad I had my grandma and my papa. No, I won't leave you out, grandpa. My grandpa was so proud of me, y'all. I went down in Forest, Mississippi one time there. Didn't know no better. But I integrated a Washeteria. He would tell everybody, "My grandbaby Mavis, she went up in that washeteria and washed her clothes. And all the black ladies followed her on up in there." I'm proud of my grandbaby. I saw many more of those signs as I lived in Mississippi. I'm so glad I can say that I saw every one of those signs. Dr. King saw that every one of those signs were taken down.